Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Russell Berman, immediate past president of the Modern Language Association, the MLA, the largest professional organization of scholars of literature in America, and the Walter A. Haas Professor in the Humanities at Stanford University. The author of numerous articles and many books, his most recent major monograph is called Fiction Sets You Free, Literature, Liberty, and Western Culture. Professor Berman will be in Memphis at Rhodes College on February 27th at 6 p.m. to give a lecture titled The Humanities in Our Culture, part of the Communities in Conversation series, which are always free and open to the public. Russell Berman, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Russell, we know that literacy rates, in the sense of people who actually read books, are down. Only 30% of students in higher education major in the liberal arts any longer. Language requirements are eroding, and in certain states, they're considering or actually shutting down whole departments in the humanities, with foreign languages being the first hit. Do you agree that the study of the humanities is in a state of crisis in America? And what do you think are the causes of the current assault on the humanities?
There's no doubt that the humanities are crucial to a quality education. And there's equally, alas, no doubt that the humanities are facing enormous assaults in the structure of higher education, and not only higher education in the United States. As you mentioned, departments are being shut down, requirements are being ratcheted back. Participation in literacy, in a certain sense, is being rolled back due to various technological transitions. One could dwell on this for quite some time and, of course, complicate the picture a bit. Through the new technologies, there's enormously increased access to literature, much greater distribution of literature for those of us who grew up with hard copy books. The transition to electronic readers can seem troubling. On the other hand, many people benefit from that. That, too, is literacy, and we shouldn't dismiss it. Nonetheless, we're going through a transformation of our culture in which the public and individuals in that public are often considerably less literate, considerably less acquainted with other cultures and languages than in the past. This is a diminishment of our collective intelligence, and it's deeply unfortunate.
And you mentioned the ways in which technology has resulted in increased access to the kinds of texts that are available and the wealth of, you know, old and new books that we can get on the internet. But on the other hand, it seems to be the case that people are reading less. I'm wondering if you have some reflections on the role of technology in the degradation of culture and the humanities.
Well, again, one would acknowledge with a lot of nuance and seeing the good with the bad as well. Nonetheless, I do believe, as you suggest, that there's a decrease in reading, especially the reading of literature. And this is in part due to technological changes, in part due to deeper cultural changes, in part, frankly, due to explicit government policy. The Department of Education has been promoting, for example, the adoption of what's called the Common Core State Standards as a precondition for access to certain federal funds for K-12 education. These terms explicitly shift away from literary reading toward informational reading. The model of literacy education in K-12 is increasingly preparing students to read manuals accurately rather than to read a novel or a poem creatively. What that means is that students are being trained less and less to develop their creativity in the use of language, and more to be able to follow explicit commands. That has political ramifications as well.
So part of what you're suggesting is the orientation now is really just about information and not really reading the kinds of texts that help to complicate our understanding of the world. Let's expand on this a little bit. Russell, nearly 10 years ago, you wrote an article in the main publication of the MLA entitled, Why Major in Literature? What Do We Tell Our Students? So I want to ask you now, what would you tell a student about why they should major in literature or in the liberal arts more generally today?
I believe that literature, most importantly, is a vehicle with which we humans cultivate our capacity for imagination, our capacity to imagine conditions, answers, solutions to the problems of the real world that do not yet offer themselves to us. We are creative animals, and literature is the tool we use, as I said before, to sharpen our imagination. That's the very source of our creative passion. In addition to that, though, students should major in literature specifically to cultivate their skills in language. Many students I know face economic pressures. Many students and parents are concerned about job opportunities, and therefore they opt rightly or wrongly for majors that seem to promise, I think often falsely, a direct access to a career. But even if they go on with a major in the science fields, they're going to need to use language to explain their ideas in science to others for the rest of their career. The study of the humanities is the study of cultivating one's skills in language. So, creativity, language, and I'll add just one more point. It's no secret that we're living in an increasingly globalized world with much greater direct connections to cultures and societies around the world. The study of languages, especially world languages, is the way to learn about how people live otherwise, how they think otherwise, and gives the student access to an international economy that is going to be blocked off unless they develop the cross-cultural skills inherent in language learning.
Is this part of the reason why, as president of the MLA, you've said that all high school students should be fluent in a language other than English? And you've actually said this is a matter of national urgency.
I have said that, and I mean it. I have called for what, in my terms, a universal bilingualism. Now, that's a tall order, that someone should be able to use a second language as well as their first. We may not get there, but we ought to get pretty close. And the problem is that while we may throw up our hands in despair in the United States, how can we ever get close to this? In fact, in many societies, very much like our own, I'm thinking of the societies of Western Europe, capacity in a second language is standard. Indeed, the European Union has set as its goal two non-native languages for all of its citizens.
Well, that's a big difference where most Americans basically function in a monolingual universe.
Russell, if we function at all. It's pretty clear from test scores that not only is our abilities in second languages going down, our abilities in English are going down. Our literacy abilities are going down, as evidenced by international testing. One reason I would suggest that our English language abilities are going down, this has nothing to do with the immigration debate. This has to do with a degradation of the quality of education. Many, many, many older Americans, many adults will remember that the first time they wrapped their head around English grammar was thanks to their class in French or Spanish or German in high school. As those classes disappear, those opportunities to master English more deeply, to understand the richness of meaning, to understand how words can't be translated on a one-to-one correspondence across national borders, all of that is disappearing. So as we lose our second languages, we are losing our first language, and we can thank the educational policymakers for this.
Russell, let's talk a little bit more deeply about your understanding of how to approach literature and what it is that the study of literature has to offer to our understanding of the world. You were one of the founders of German Cultural Studies in America, and in one snarling review of your book called The Rise of the Modern German Novel, you were actually accused of the Frankfurtization of American criticism. For an audience likely unfamiliar with theory and specifically with the Frankfurt School, which was a primary aspect of your own approach to literature, can you tell us a little bit about the Frankfurt School and a little bit about cultural studies and how cultural studies challenged the conventional approach to literature?
I'd be happy to. Well, as the Frankfurt School was initially an institute at the University of Frankfurt in the western part of Germany, founded before the Second World War, before Hitler came to power. When Hitler came to power, its leading figures had to flee Germany. Many of them came to the United States. The Frankfurt School was a variant of what is sometimes called the Western Marxism, that is, a study of culture with regard to the context of a capitalist economy. In contrast to Eastern Marxism, Orthodox Marxism, Soviet Marxism, Western Marxism was never about how to make a revolution, but how to understand culture in capitalism, its pros and its cons, its advantages and its disadvantages. In my book, arrives the modern German novel, I trace the transformation of the novel, a core literary genre, from the mid-19th century in Germany, that is before the Bismarck era, before the unification of Germany, through the end of the Second World War. The contention is that the work of art conveys knowledge about the social world in which it arose. What's more, that work of art not only conveys knowledge in the sense of information, but it conveys critical insight into that. Now, if a critic accuses my book of Frankfurtization, that critic may well have been writing from the standpoint of a so-called new criticism, a mode of literary reading that was prevalent in the United States in the mid-20th century, in which focus was directed solely to the literary work itself and its form, only asking intra-literary questions rather than asking questions about the relationship between literature and the world around it. I think, frankly, that when most people read, they're interested not only in the complexity of the text, the beauty of the language, but they're also interested in what the book says about the world. That's what I believe in the context of this review, Frankfurtization may have meant.
But can you say a little bit more then about the way in which German cultural studies and cultural studies in general has thought about what teaching literature is all about and what's important about it insofar as it understands each work of literature as within a broader world of which it is a part?
Cultural studies is another term altogether that emerged in the United Kingdom and then came to the United States in the 1970s and 1980s. And in many ways, it's like the Frankfurt School work. In important ways, it's different than the Frankfurt School work. Let me just highlight one important similarity and one important difference. What cultural studies, originally British cultural studies, and Frankfurt School criticism have in common is a passion for asking questions about the connection between the cultural object, in my case the novel, could be the poem, the painting, and the society in which it was produced, sometimes the society in which it's read, which it's received. So both of them share that perspective on the wider context, which, as I suggested before, the new criticism or other formalisms would reject.
And part of what you've indicated is that within cultural studies, it broadened out the kinds of texts that people looked at. So part of what came along with this was a sense that maybe the works of high literature could be understood in relationship to works of low literature, and that other kinds of cultural objects, even museums or the ways in which cities themselves were laid out or more popular kinds of cultural forms themselves, merited the kind of detailed analysis as a cultural object that had previously been only the domain of works of high literature.
That's absolutely right. Cultural studies has famously expanded the domain of objects studied horizontally, if you will, out through society, looking at everyday objects as well as multiple forms of works of art. Actually, the Frankfurt School did that as well in a somewhat different way, focusing in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s on, say, questions of film as a form of popular culture. So both Frankfurt and cultural studies had democratizing agenda, if you will, that is going beyond high culture. They work with a somewhat different register, though. In the case of cultural studies, my sense is, and I'm a critic of this aspect of cultural studies, the differences among the different types of objects get leveled, and there's not a lot of attention paid to the difference between the literary work and the work of everyday life. In the case of Frankfurt, there's a willingness to look at that wider terrain, but the distinction between high and low, or the distinction between the fictional and the non-fictional, become points of investigation and provide a kind of leverage for criticism of society.
So let's say a song that might be on the Grammys, for example, doesn't necessarily have the same kinds of critical capacity built into it as a Schoenberg work of symphonic music?
Perhaps not. I'd hesitate to generalize, but in at least some variants of Frankfurt, there's a lot of value, placed on the complexity of the work as a vehicle for criticism of society. in one variant of the Frankfurt School thinking associated with Theodor Adorno in particular, the work of art that is most artistic, most difficult, most resistant to easy listening consumption is valued as ultimately the source of the strongest criticism of, say, tendencies toward conformism in society.
We're going to pick up on precisely that point, the way in which literature can serve as a critical perspective on society. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. With me today is Russell Berman, who just finished a year stint as president of the Modern Language Association. Professor Berman will be in Memphis at Rhodes College on February 27th at 6 p.m. to give a lecture titled The Humanities in Our Culture, part of the Communities in Conversation series, which are always free and open to the public. In anticipation of his visit, we're talking about the study of literature and the humanities at a transformative moment in Western culture. Now, Russell, I'm wondering whether there's a tension between your earlier ventures into cultural studies via the Frankfurt School and your strong support of studying the canon in Fiction Sets You Free. And by the canon, I mean, of course, the set of great works in the literary tradition that constitute the heart of what literary studies has conventionally focused upon. Great books, that is.
There may well be some tension. There may well be some transition in the course of 20 or 30 years of writing. Frankly, I'd be frightened if there were no tension and no transition. Nonetheless, the point that you're making is that in my earlier openness to cultural studies and that broader, say, democratic array of objects, that there's a difference between that and my argument for the study of the canon in my 2007 Fiction Sets You Free. In Fiction Sets You Free, I don't preclude looking at everyday objects, and in the earlier, I didn't preclude looking at the canon, but I don't want to dodge the question. The critique of the canon that took place in the United States in the 1980s, 1990s, often associated with cultural studies, was driven by a desire to open the study of literature up to authors previously not studied, population groups perhaps previously excluded from the world of high culture, an examination of genre that had not yet received significant scholarly attention. All of that's for the good. To the extent, however, that the dismantling of the canon, that is, the list of great works, led to a disorientation within the study of literature by erasing points of scholarly convergence, it damaged, I believe, the institution of the study of literature. I'd add to that the specific claim that I make in Fiction Sets You Free, and that is that great works become great in part through an engagement or a competition with great works in the past. That is, the ambitious young writer who wants to make her mark on the literary world today is going to be competing with the works that motivated her the most as a reader in the past. That generates a trans-historical, transgenerational lineage of writing. The writer today is an engagement with the writer of yesterday who is engaged with the writer of the day before yesterday. And that lineage, sometimes called tradition, is a crucial dimension of literary life and of our life as a culture.
And part of what you suggest in Fiction Sets You Free that's important about that aspect of the tradition over time, and these great books in particular that make up the canon, is precisely their connection to the ways in which they open up the possibilities of criticism and of a critical perspective on the present. And they do so, I guess, in two different ways. That's part of what you're suggesting. One is by trying to rethink creatively the forms of communication, the ways in which you can write or say something, but also the ways in which they invoke the past of literature, which itself, you suggest, has a critical perspective on the present.
I believe that one problem in our contemporary culture is what is sometimes called presentism, an exclusive focus on the present, on the structures of the present. It's the illusion that we can be absolutely up to date without a knowledge of the past or an aspiration for the future. We're losing a complex sense of temporality in which past and future merge in the present, and replacing it with an exclusive focus on the now. Literature is one way to recall our history. Recalling our history through the imagination allows us to imagine a possible future.
Russell, one way to read Fiction Sets You Free is as a response to the current arguments against literature and the humanities in our culture today. Since you make a really big argument about the centrality of literature to the specifically Western conception of liberty, individualism, political democracy, and free market capitalism, I want to ask you to reduce a complex argument that takes a book to fully unfold to its core claim. What's the central argument of Fiction Sets You Free?
The central argument in the book is that literature has played a central role in the constitution of Western culture and society. It's played a central role in the wake of the acquisition of writing, that is to say, the dissemination of literacy, which became foundational for our notion of individualism, of individual personhood, that it has therefore contributed to a sense of the urgency of political forms that defend the freedom of that personhood, I'll call that liberal democracy, and that this freedom of expression inherent in literature and freedom of the person inherent in the form of government is linked intimately to freedom of the market.
Russell, Fiction Sets You Free is a book that's bookended by two works you've authored for the Hoover Institution, Anti-Americanism in Europe, written just after 9/11, and Freedom or Terror, Europe Faces Jihad, most recently. In Freedom or Terror, you write, and here I'm quoting you, "Our concern, therefore, with Europe's response to Islamist terrorism necessarily involves this Europe, the Europe of multiculturalism and post-traditionalism, decadent Europe, facing this Islamism, frenzied, fanatic, and ideological. Sophisticated self-doubt faces vitality and violence. It's a war of ideas, but even more, a war of values and a war of will." Could this line sum up the pathos of what ties together your last several publications, this war of ideas, as you put it? And are you speaking as much about America here as you are about Europe?
Of course I'm speaking about America as well. Let me explain for our listeners. I'm a scholar of literature, of German literature, of European literature, but I'm also an American scholar. As a scholar of Germany, I try to explain Germany to Americans. That is to say, I study literature. That's a topic in Fiction Sets You Free, but I feel it's also my obligation to try to explain, to understand, to research, to ask questions about European culture. In the first of those two books, I discussed aspects of the European response to the United States in the era of the Iraq War. And in that, I was quite critical of the proliferation of a wave of anti-Americanism, and I tried to explore the cultural sources of that anti-Americanism in Europe and its difference in different European countries. In the second book, I revisited Europe, in a sense, several years later, asking not so much about the European response to the United States, but the European response to the wave of terrorist events that had taken place during that decade. In a sense, the first book was about Europe looking at America in the wake of 9/11. The second book was Europe looking at Europe in the wake of the bombings in London and Madrid and elsewhere.
But can you just say how Fiction Sets You Free fits into those issues? Because the question of liberty, the question of freedom, they're there in the two titles of the last two books. So this specific defense of literature within Western culture, how does that fit into what you wrote in the other two books about anti-Americanism and about Islamism?
The two political books are not primarily about literature, but you're absolutely right. They're in discussion with Fiction Sets You Free because Fiction Sets You Free sets out an agenda that describes Western culture in terms of individualism and liberty, and that these desiderata are definitive for the tradition that we emerge from and the goals that we pursue. How one translates them day by day into particular policies, well, that's a matter for another discussion. But one policy that was of particular concern, especially in the second of the two political books, was counterterrorism. How were Europeans responding to the problems around Islamist terror that they themselves faced? It was one thing to see them develop a criticism of the United States because of 9/11. It was quite another to ask, how would they respond to attacks on their own soil? And there in the book, I tried to differentiate. But Europeans had to work through the constraints that a certain variant of multiculturalism in Europe put on their ability to respond to terrorist agenda that was emerging on their own soil.
Well, maybe it's a little bit of a stretch, but you used the word multiculturalism, and maybe we could draw a parallel between that and multi kinds of texts. And I want to use that leap as a way to come back in my last question to where your career as a scholar of literature began, since I think that at least some scholars, maybe most scholars who come out of the tradition of critical theory, as you have, wouldn't really understand the defense in your lost books of what they might term a very Eurocentric and idealized view of Western culture that you present. Let me put this starkly. One could suggest that your own arguments about how literature imagines an alternative to reality could be belied by the overlaps in the way in which you defend Western culture and liberty and critique Islamism, since on the surface it sounds a lot like popular right-wing rhetoric in America, but in a very sophisticated academic voice. And I can hear some people saying, this is not really an alternative. This is the dominant discourse. So what would you say to such critics about how your viewpoint is really a critical perspective, and at the same time, an important voice defending the humanities and its role in our culture?
Critique of Islamism. And let me be clear, this is not a critique of Islam, the religion. This is a critique of the radical politicals who have, I would say, perhaps hijacked that religion in the pursuit of particular extremist agenda, that the critique of that kind of fanaticism is by no means inconsistent with the Frankfurt School's critique of Nazism and fascism that is hardwired into that tradition. To suggest otherwise, I think, misunderstands critical theory in the Frankfurt School. Critical theory, the Frankfurt School, but I will say any genuine engagement with literature that is about creativity and human freedom has to find itself clearly opposed to agenda driven by repression, violence, and brutal patriarchy. I don't see anything problematic with that line of thinking. On the contrary, what I find problematic is the line of thinking that suggests that defense of freedom is somehow inappropriate. Now, this is the very core of literature.
Russell Berman, thanks so much for helping us to see the ways in which the study of literature really is connected up with the most important issues that we face globally today. And thanks so much for being with us on Counterpoint.
Thank you.
As part of the Communities in Conversation series, Russell Berman will give a lecture on the humanities in our culture at Rhodes College on February 27th. At 6 p.m. in Blount Auditorium. For more information, visit the Rhodes website at rhodes.edu or visit the Rhodes College Communities in Conversation page on Facebook and like it to keep posted about this biweekly series of events with leading scholars, philosophers, historians, and thought leaders, always free and open to the public. To listen to this interview or other episodes of Counterpoint, visit us at WKNOFM.org, where you will find the Counterpoint link under the News menu item. For an automated podcast of Counterpoint, on the Counterpoint page, click on the podcast link and then just decide if you want to use iTunes or another player to retrieve the latest shows. Counterpoint is a production of WKNOFM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.